All right, everybody. Hi. This is the continuation of Esoteric Astrology Adventure, number 108, section B. And we've just been dealing with four symbols: the triangle, the star, the square, and the cross. Two of them related to objectivity and the outward focus of the man, that is the square and the cross being the transitional mechanism to lift the human consciousness into the area of the star and eventually into that of the monad or triangle. Although we have other triangles, which are not the monad, we have the triangle of the spiritual triad, which is the expression of the monad. We have the triangle of the soul. The soul is sometimes called the triangles. We now come to a brief study of the rulers of this sign. As Taurus is so close, esoterically speaking, to the sign Aries, which in this world cycle is the sign of beginnings, it constitutes, relatively speaking, a very complex aggregation of forces. This is really something we have to deal with. We're not going to consider any of these signs as strictly monolithic. They have many, many parts, even as our little planet, the expression of our planetary locus, has so many different aspects to it, all the more so for these great constellations. And we have been seeing that Taurus is a sign of impulsion, just as Aries is, and is responsible for great movement and momentum. Sometimes I think it's possible to relate Vulcan to Aries in a certain sense, even though more closely to Taurus. And Vulcan is a planet which is an initiator. There's plenty of the first ray involved in the aggregation of forces, which is Aries, and also in Taurus. The impulse of first ray is there. So Taurus is close. It's proximate. It's an adjacent sign to Aries, but it's also esoterically close, and it has to do with the impulsive aspects which bring creation into being. So, at least in this world cycle, Aries, to the sign Aries, which in this world cycle, would it be different in other world cycles? That would be interesting. Which in this world cycle is the sign of beginning. It constitutes, relatively speaking, a very complex aggregation of forces, being related not only to Aries with its cosmic contacts, but also to the Pleiades and the Great Bear. So Taurus is definitely related to the Pleiades. When you look through the constellation Taurus, which is closer to us than that of the Pleiades, we do see the Pleiades directly. There is an alignment at this time between the Pleiades and the constellation Taurus. We don't know whether it is always the case, as there is a type of revolution occurring in our solar system which would lead to or show a different type of alignment as one looks towards the Pleiades. but also to Pleiades and the Great Bear. And we know as well that Aries is intimately related to the Great Bear, at least. We see that on page 50 of Esoteric Psychology and Astrology. Let's take a look there. And we see here, in this important tabulation 3, the Great Bear, Aries, Libra, and the Sun veiling Vulcan. And this is showing, interestingly, that this exalted Sun in Aries is actually, in this particular context, veiling the sign Vulcan, which relates Aries to Taurus via Vulcan. Excuse me. Okay. Yet, at the same time, it is very simple in its expression, for it is governed by only two planets, just as Capricorn is governed by only two planets, and Cancer is governed by only two planets, and really one, actually, because we should not consider the moon as really the governing ruler of Cancer. So there are cosmic relations of a complex kind when considering Taurus, but simplicity of expression. I think this is something we want to bear in mind. Venus is its exoteric ruler, and Vulcan its esoteric and hierarchical ruler, and hence the simplicity. Interesting that Venus really, at this time, a more advanced planet than Vulcan is, at least in terms of its unfoldment, is the exoteric ruler. It's the same thing in Sagittarius. We have Jupiter, a very advanced planet, as the exoteric ruler of Sagittarius, and Mars, as a still non-sacred planet, as the hierarchical ruler, and Earth also. Sagittarius has two planets which are non-sacred as two of its rulers, though in the higher position. So there are some enigmas there, I would say. So Venus is the exoteric ruler, and Vulcan the esoteric and hierarchical ruler. Exoteric and esoteric here. We touch upon one of the mysteries of the ageless wisdom. A mystery, of course, can be revealed, but to the particular state of consciousness considering the mystery, its understanding remains veiled. Venus holds a unique relation to the Earth, being its alter ego, correct? Venus holds a unique relation to the Earth, different to that of any other planet, although Venus is related, as are all the planets, to all the planets. But these two are a pair, are twins together, just as the Logos of Sirius and the Logos of our Soto Logos are intimately related. And probably what is said here of Venus could be said on a higher turn of the spiral of Sirius, in relation to our sun, Sol, or Helios. So Venus holds a unique relation to the Earth, different to that of any other planet, and this, therefore, brings about a much closer relation between Taurus and the Earth than perhaps exists in any other zodiacal relation where our planet is concerned. So even though the Earth is the ruler of Gemini, hierarchically, and the ruler of Sagittarius, esoterically, the zodiacal connection of Earth and Taurus is very, very close, because Venus has a uniquely close relationship to the Earth, and Venus is a ruler of Taurus. So it is the Venus relation to the Earth and the Venus relation to Taurus which brings Taurus and Earth into a very close proximity, and they both share these earthy qualities, and also the factor of illumination. Earth is to become a great illuminating or illuminated center, eventually a great lighted sphere as a sacred planet, and Taurus is the mother of illumination, and Venus is the most luminous planet from a relative point of view, as seen from the Earth. So DK is being careful about time and space here. He's saying, in saying this, I mean in this particular world cycle, whatever the world cycle really is, because it seems to mean a number of things. Does it mean a solar system, perhaps? And at this particular stage of evolutionary unfoldment in which mankind now finds itself. What we have here is, I would call it by the term, the veil of generality. We use a general term to cover a number of different, in this case, time cycles. The term world cycle, obviously, you know, can represent a round. It can represent a scheme round. It can represent the duration of a planet. It can represent the duration of a solar system. Probably other things it can represent as well. there are great cycles called Platonic years, and they last about 25,000 years, and one might be able to consider them world cycles, but they are a relatively short duration when considering these planetary relationships and these zodiacal relationships. Okay. Now, this connection of Venus, Taurus, and the Earth will probably implicate Vulcan as well and make it a planet very closely related to the Earth. We have good reason to believe that there are Vulcanian egos here on the Earth sent here in order to learn something about sentiency, sensitivity, and the astral body. And these, I think, among them are what's called the primary lotuses, which DK describes in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. So he says that there's a very close relation, perhaps the closest, between Taurus and the Earth, the closest type of zodiacal relation which Earth has. In saying this, I mean in this particular world cycle and at the peculiar stage of evolutionary unfoldment at which mankind now finds itself, which, you know, we might say this is characterized by the transmutation of desire into aspiration, as must definitely occur when a being is becoming a disciple, and humanity is becoming a disciple at this time. All is in a state of flux and change. It's all relative, and there is no fixity in these relationships, especially over time. There is an apparent fixity for shorter periods of time, and especially in terms of how humanity can perceive change. But no ultimate fixity here. All is in a state of flux and change. As man unfolds his consciousness, other constellations may come into pronounced activity in conjunction with the controlling sign. I would imagine that Scorpio would be one, and he already talks about the importance of Scorpio at this time to advance man, and everyone is involved really in these Scorpionic conflicts at this time. Scorpio, interestingly, is the sign which rules humanity as a whole. I think if we go here to try to make this a little quick, and this is let's see, this is our right here. Perhaps we can see this if we move forward enough. Yes, and here, as you have sometimes seen in the past, we do have the sign Scorpio as the ruler of the fourth creative or human hierarchy, the fourth creative hierarchy, the human creative hierarchy. And it's involved, interestingly, with the expression of the word, which one might think of as associated with Taurus, because Taurus rules the throat and rules sound. There are so many relationships that can be gathered if one studies this chart very closely. All of its interrelationships, or at least some of them, will begin to appear, and many are subtle and not yet expressed in any way that humanity would notice. Okay, so other constellations, Leo, the most human of all the signs, Scorpio, that which rules the fourth creative hierarchy, Leo and Scorpio, for instance, may come into pronounced activity. Now, they are always active, but the question is, to what degree can humanity receive their energies and interact their with their energies and deliberately invoke an augmentation of their energies, which would be useful to human advancement. With a controlling sign, and still others may become more remote in their contact and effect. Well, you know, like Cancer, let's just say. Oh, how about the spelling, huh? And the typing. Cancer was so pronounced in the first part, we are told, of the previous solar system, and now almost as a symbol. From the Earth perspective, the constellation Cancer is very faded. It is dim. Its light is not easily noticeable. One might pass over this constellation altogether if one did not know of its existence. But Leo and Gemini, flanking the constellation Cancer, are both very prominent, and we know how much they have to do with modern man and with his individualization. The human kingdom would not have come into being without the good offices of Leo, the sign of individualization, and Gemini, the sign of the relationship between the pairs of opposites, in this case, Gemini and Sagittarius, producing the interplay which led to the formation of the fourth kingdom of nature. So there will be signs that are increasing in prominence, and there will be signs that are fading, not necessarily in their overall activity with respect to other receptive centers, but with respect to humanity, because humanity will have already passed through the stage where the influence of that particular sign or constellation is needed. All right, so DK has a good idea of how this will all unfold, and we are just beginning to grasp it a bit. The signs upon the fixed cross are very important to humanity, all of them, and we are entering a period of great individualization. Well, individuality, let me call it that way. When many human beings will become integrated personalities, thus the importance of the sign Leo. But we are also entering a period in which humanity is becoming the world disciple, and to be a disciple means to struggle between competing pairs of opposites, hence the importance of Scorpio. Today, however, Taurus, Venus, and Earth have a very close karmic relation. Notice that, because people talk about getting rid of their karma and not having to incarnate anymore, when karma is a great cosmic law and involves in its process planets, constellations, and I suppose galaxies and even greater structures. So today, however, Taurus, Venus, and the Earth have a very close karmic relation and a very definite dharma to work out together. I would say what occurs to me is the dharma of producing light. Earth is to become a great lighted station. Venus is already the most developed of all the planets, though not necessarily the most spiritually elevated. It is the most unfolded, and it is a great source of luminosity, I suppose having to do with the stage of evolution at which the solar logos finds itself. If Venus is currently much related to the solar plexus of our solar logos, we see something about the astral polarization of our present solar logos, working, though he is, towards cosmic mental polarization. And then we shall see, you know, whether the light of Venus will be reduced in some way, though it is also connected with the solar logoic heart center, which presumably will continue to increase in its radiance. This is a cosmic fire issue, but sometimes I've wondered whether three planets, whether there is not a defining triangle connected with each one of the chakras of the solar logos, and perhaps with each one of our chakras as well. We already have two planets said to be connected with our chakras. For instance, Here, if we go to, if we go to page 517, which you have seen, I imagine, in this series, we have some chakras in which more than one planet is involved. For instance, the throat center involved both Earth and Saturn. Is the possibility that another planet is involved in the expression of the throat? Well, we know Uranus is. For the heart center, we have the Sun, Jupiter. What about Venus? DK implicates Venus in the expression of the heart center. For the solar plexus center, we have Neptune and Mars, but again, what about Venus? Is it possible? Since Venus has much to do with the solar plexus of our solar logos, what about man in terms of the elevation of that center? The sacral center, pretty much just Uranus, but Mars, we know, really should be involved, and the moon to a certain extent, and thus it goes. Perhaps, indeed, we will discover that we have a triangle of planets associated with each chakra. And these are triangles in revolution, and at different times in the development of the entity, a different planet will be in the ascendancy with respect to that chakra. I think a very good example is the throat center, which involves the Earth, Saturn, and then the seventh ray, which must implicate Uranus. And it seems to me that there is a progression there, that for ordinary man, the Earth is the ruler, for the disciple it's Saturn, and for the initiate, maybe, we can consider it to be Uranus, as the words of the initiate become magically effective under the seventh ray, which is distributed mainly by Uranus. Okay, well, you can see how the different things the Tibetan says can lead off into various speculations about relationships which are simply implied, or which the understanding of which can emerge intuitively as we study what is given. But there's a definite karmic relationship here, and also a dharma to work out. And that dharma, as I've been saying, I believe, since two out of the three have so much to do with light, will be in relation to the production of light. Just what that karma and relationship may prove eventually to be lies beyond ordinary human understanding, but some idea of it may be gained by relating in your mind the words, and notice how he says we can gain light, huh? Relating certain words in our mind will desire light and plan. Well, will, desire, light, and even plan are all Taurian in their nature. Will and plan are much related to the Earth. When it comes to Venus, we have the light and the elevation of desire as well. In voicing it thus, I but step down and distort the relation. But until men can think in simple symbols, as the plan is expressed in simple symbols, and without words, and can interpret these hitherto unrecognized symbols correctly, more is not possible. And we do know that occasionally DK gives certain symbols upon which the human being must ponder. But let's just say the initiate consciousness is one of simplification. So we're always moving towards simplification as we elevate the stature of our evolution. And because a thing is simple does not mean that it is not profound. And because a thing is complex, it does not mean that it is profound. Master Moria deals with this all the time, talking about complexity and simplicity, and advising that it is wisest to choose simplicity. So will, desire, light, and the planet. We do get the idea that it is the will and desire of our planetary logos to produce a great demonstration of light. This tremendous demonstration of light already exists in Taurus, and under the influence of Venus and Taurus, the Earth will become what I call a great lighted sphere, and this will have something to do with achieving its particular type of sacredness. And at that time, I suppose, the Kundalini process within our solar system will really be activated, because the Earth represents the base of the spine center in connection with our solar logos. So if there is a lighted activation of the base of the spine center, it will correspond to certain high initiatory states of the solar logos, which require the distribution of Kundalini. So our solar logos has not yet achieved the third cosmic initiation, but when it does, and when he achieves the fourth, and even perhaps the fifth in this particular solar system, the Kundalini will have to be more activated than it is, and the Earth, as the a major distributor of solar logoic Kundalini, will have to be similarly activated. To understand the relation of Venus and the Earth, I would have you ponder on what I earlier gave in A Tree as a Cosmic Fire, and these, you know, two books go hand in hand. We can understand that to understand either one of these books, a constant cross-referencing between them is very useful. The entire relationship can be summed up in the words, the planet Venus is to the planet Earth what the higher self is to the personality. Well, Venus very definitely does represent the soul of man. And the solar angelic soul of man is intimately related to Venus, just as the four square personality of man is related to the Earth. The planet Venus is to the planet Earth what the higher self is to the personality. So from a certain respect, Venus must be a teacher of our planetary logos, just as Sirius is a teacher of our solar logos. Always there is a greater one to impart that which must be assimilated by a lesser one. The planet Venus is to the planet Earth what the higher self is to the personality, and therefore more enduring in a sense. So there's even the analogy of endurance, more enduring. Remember, he says that not all planets last throughout the Maha Manvantara. Well, Earth does not last throughout the Maha Manvantara, but Venus does. So you wonder how many Earth cycles may exist compared to one Venus cycle. Maybe, you know, there are incarnations or activations of various planets during a Maha Manvantara. You wonder how continuous is the activation of Venus when compared to the activation of the Earth scheme. Well, that's a remote, recondite kind of consideration, but you know, you try to use the law of analogy to help explain things that are not fully explained in the text. Remember that the planet Venus is one of the seven sacred planets, whereas the Earth is not. And the sacred planets are definitely identified with the soul level, and they probably, well, they've all taken a type of fifth initiation. And we remember that there are lesser initiations and greater initiations connected with the planetary logo. For instance, Earth is passing through a fourth initiation of a certain type, of a certain caliber, and not yet a fifth. And obviously, in that same type of series, Venus has passed through a fifth initiation, though not the fifth cosmic initiation. As a matter of fact, Earth hasn't even passed through the second cosmic initiation. And I suppose Venus has. Remember that the planet Venus is one of the seven sacred planets, whereas the Earth is not. This statement involves, as you can see, a deep mystery of relativity, of interplay, and of eventual revelation. Well, the relativity has to do with the relative degree of advancement. Oh, that's relation. Degree of advancement of the planetary logoi, and even of the solar, of the planetary logoi, yes, and, logoi, and even of the solar logoi, and the zodiacal lords, all at different stages of advancement, interplaying according to their stage of advancement and the degree to which they can serve each other, and the eventual revelation, which comes when the entire system has reached its archetypal perfection. So what will this revelation be? This revelation as to the relation of the Earth's alter ego to the world of human life will only be revealed at the third initiation. And interestingly, this connects Venus and the fifth ray. Oh, that's round. I want to try that with the third initiation. Mm-hmm. So much is to be revealed at the third initiation in connection with Venus, because we will learn the relation of the soul and the personality more completely than ever before at the third degree, and also of Venus as a higher type of being or soul to the Earth, which will represent the personality. So that will be a revelation accorded at the third degree, at which time all glamour and illusion is dissipated. All glamour and illusion. That's quite a statement, because elsewhere he tells us that illusion, in a greater sense, lasts or persists even until the ninth degree. And from a certain point of view, there's certain thoughts that suggest that the entire universe is illusion, is a great maya. So much depends upon how we define illusion. Sometimes we can define it as anything other than the absoluteness or the infinity of infinities. But then again, is there anything other than that anyway? So it's a mysterious factor, and there are much lesser mysteries which remain opaque to us. So how can we solve these greatest of all mysteries? But we can at least send some thought in their direction. So this revelation as to the relation of the Earth's alter ego, Venus, to the world of human life will only be revealed at the third degree, because a great impartation is coming from Venus and from the Venus factors of our Earth scheme, which will elevate a man into the domain of Venus, the higher mind, and thus reveal what Venus has done for the rising human soul, at which time all glamour and illusion is dissipated. That's a tall order, isn't it? Third degree. A tall order. Yes. Let's put that in red. Okay. Put that in red. It seems so drastic, so ultimate. All glamour, I can see so. All illusion, well, I wonder if there are not certain ahamkaric illusions which can only be dissipated by the Buddhic energy sometime between the third and the fourth degree. But I think DK is making a general statement regarding the customary, the usually encountered illusions. And the light which shines through the eye of the bull will be unimpeded and carry light into the darkness. So this certainly means the activation of the third eye. Uh, Yes, the activation of the third eye, in which Venus is involved, but also Vulcan. When St. Paul seemed to have his third eye activated and to be blinded by the light which came through it, it certainly seems there was a Vulcanian impression there, as well as a more gentle Venusian impression. But anyway, the third degree is high. The third degree is a soul degree. The soul really then becomes the majority. It is the major factor. The musical fifth is sounding fourth at that point. And Venus, which represents the soul, is understood in a deeper way because the soul is realized as a truer and more stable identity than that of the personality. At the third degree, we really can say we are focused within the fullness of our accumulated gifts. We are focused within the causal body. Venus connotes in our minds, even if we have only a glimmer of occult truth, and even a glimmer can serve, that which is mental, that which concerns final sublimation, which is the raising of a substance in a certain state towards a higher state. Probably some of us remember in chem lab what the sublimation or vaporization of iodine is like, and how we take it from the solid to the vaporous state, apparently without passing through the liquid state. I'm a little rusty on all that. It took place more than 50 years ago. But this is how I remember it. That which is mental, that which concerns final sublimation, or the sublimation of personality into soul, let's call it that, sublimation of personality energies into soul energies, and that which deals with sex to a degree, although he qualifies that, and that which must work out into symbolic expression upon the physical plane. So this Venusian world of the soul, with ruled by soul laws, must express in this lower Martian lunar world. And at least the symbols of that higher world must be visible to the mind which can interpret it with spiritual discernment. So the very first of the cities to be found on the higher mental plane, connected with the third subplane, a spiritual discernment can be related to Venus, and to look at the ways that the soul expresses itself through symbol on the outer level. So there are four factors here connected with Venus. Oopsie. Okay. Four factors. Mentalities, sublimation, sex, and symbolic expression. These are the major concepts which enter our minds when Venus and Taurus are considered in unison. Well, certainly we have the sex factor involved with Taurus, one of the major sexual signs. We have illumination of the mind connected with Taurus. Not sure here about sublimation per se. And Taurus is also one of those very visual signs, and having the expression of the fourth ray will aid in the interpretation of symbolism. In other words, the shape of the configuration will reveal a higher state of reality. In any case, Venus is connected with these four factors, and so are Venus and Taurus together. These factors of expression have ever been related to these two since the night of time, because they are essentially basic and eternally cosmic in their implications. So cosmic mentality, the constant elevation of lower states into higher through what we call Sublimation. I think we can see here the sublimation of the sex instinct. Sub under Taurus. Leading to illumination. So Taurus is the sign in which sexual energy is sublimated into a higher form of creativity, and in which the single eye of unitive perception is activated because of the sublimation of the sex energy. At least that's one of the major ways that this happens. So both of these are concerned here, and one of the ways of understanding the higher worlds is, of course, through symbolism. So when we look at the outer world and see certain factors in a symbolic light, we are immediately related to higher dimensions where the realities to which the symbol points find their focus, find their home. So these factors of expression have ever been related to these two since the night of time, because they are essentially basic and eternally cosmic in their implications. There are cosmic implications to all of these, to mentality, to sublimation or elevation, to sex, the relationship between the great pairs of opposites, spirit and matter throughout cosmos, and the fact that in order to reach the realization of a higher state of consciousness or being, symbolism is always a method. It is the means by which a higher state is represented within the context of a lower state. It is the means of finding within the lower worlds a resonance with the higher worlds. So a symbolic interpretive vision of the lower worlds will reveal the higher, and the disciples are to develop this sense of symbolism. Okay, Taurus is one of the signs which veils a certain divine mystery. Well, I suppose every sign veils some sort of divine mystery, but let's see what he means here. For the sake of disciples in training, these four concepts may be briefly summed up in an archaic writing of great significance. Let's list these again before we get into it. Mentality, sublimation, sex, and symbolism. Four factors. And this writing states, the holy sons of mind embraced the two. They saw and understood. Thus was sex born, and thus the great mistake was made. I suppose what we're referring to here is the sin of the mindless, which was a great retardant in the early days of human evolution. The mind was outward turned, and that is the lower five-pointed star, the inverted pentagram. The form appears to view and not the life. So this is the extroversion of consciousness, without the symbolic interpretive faculty which points to the higher realities. The holy sons of mind, I suppose these are the solar angels particularly, and we're talking about the division of the sexes. Here is the eating of the apple of knowledge. This is individualization, and the eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge. We have to realize how very symbolic are the ancient writings, the ancient scriptures, and those who interpret these writings in a strictly literal way are confining themselves to a type of ignorance from which it is difficult to escape, and in which millions upon millions are today immersed. They don't have the faculty of the abstract mind developed very much, and they have to stick to concretions and interpret in terms of concretions. So the male and female were embraced, and yet the sons of mine worked through both. Because of individualization, there was an awakening. Let's call it awakening out of a primitive, let's call it participation, mystique. Awakening out of that primitive unity, which is the characteristic of the non-individualized consciousness. From another point of view, the potencies of Sagittarius and Gemini are involved here as two. The holy sons of mind, in a way, descended into the consciousness of the human animal and created individualized self-consciousness which could see and understand its own distinctness. So there was a seeing and understanding of distinctness of identity. But reading it all together, the holy sons of mind embraced the two. They saw and understood. And who is the they, the holy sons of mind or the two? Thus was sex born, and thus the great mistake was made. It's the mind was outward turned, the form appeared to view, and not the life. The question is, what is the law, and how will the sexual impulse be used? Will it be used correctly and in relation to those of one's own kind, or will the law be transgressed and various types of bestiality engaged in, leading to a retardation of human evolution and to the entrapment of individualized egos in animal bodies, such as we are told is the case with the anthropoid apes today? The holy sons of mine embraced the two. They saw and understood. Thus was sex born, and thus the great mistake was made. The mind was outward turned. The form appears to view, and not the life. And so many still are in this state, where the form which the senses reveal is considered to be the true reality. Out of the dark they cried aloud, the holy sons of mind. The holy sons of mine had descended. In pain they cried aloud. They inward looked and knew the error they had made, but knew not what to do. The Lord, presumably the planetary Logos, gave to them the sign of resurrection, eventual resurrection. So this is a combination sort of the human consciousness and the sons of mind that had descended to fortify the human. This is an experience of the soul in incarnation. Let's call it that, the experience of the soul in incarnation, realizing what had been done and that there had been a violation of the law with respect to sex and reproduction. They realized that they had trapped themselves further in form. They were outward turned, the consciousness was outward turned, and even monstrous forms which were not intended to be made were made, and these served as prisons for some of those who were responsible for their making. Out of the dark, which is the darkness of consciousness when it is immersed in form, they cried aloud to their superiors, the holy sons of mind. In pain they cried aloud. They looked inward towards the soul and knew the error they had made, but knew not what to do, and the Lord gave to them the sign of resurrection. There is a sense in which these holy sons of mind could be considered the pure human being, perhaps. The pure human being. when we deal with sons of mine, holy sons of mine, Manasseh, Putras, and the like, it's sometimes difficult to distinguish whether we are talking about the solar angel, pure and simple, or the combination of man and the solar angel, or man alone. But let's just say that man alone was not responsible for the birth of sex. This was a decision made by the planetary logos and probably in some way orchestrated by those karmic agents that we call solar angels. So let's put that down. Solar angels are karmic agents and probably were involved in the orchestration of the division of the sexes. But it was not the solar angelic consciousness that made the great mistake. It was the benighted human consciousness, even though in a way sustained by the consciousness of the solar angel, but this limited ignorant consciousness made the great mistake. Now another mistake from a larger perspective is simply the objectification of consciousness and forgetting that which the senses reveal is not the reality, but becoming totally extroverted in that sense, and it takes a long time before the introversion of consciousness can occur. Out of the dark, they cried aloud, the holy sons of mind. In pain, they cried aloud. Pain is one of the purposes of Sanat Kumara, the necessitating of pain, because pain is the lash which drives more speedily towards realization. They, upon this painful planet, planet of woe and distress, there is an awakening to the painful condition and the return of the prodigal son, which ultimately is the factor of resurrection. They inward looked. They looked towards the soul. They looked towards their higher nature, and knew they had turned outwardly in error. And of course, that outward turning was made even more difficult by the sin of the mindless, which is a material expression of the objectification of consciousness and a disregarding of the inner law. They inward looked and knew the error that they had made, but knew not what to do, because they had lost the good laws which were meant to guide them. And the Lord replied and gave to them the sign of resurrection, including the ancient mysteries which lead to the processes of elevation and eventually to resurrection. So much is contained in just these few words. And so DK asks us, do you grasp the significance of this statement and its fundamental simplicity? Let me give you a hint. The earthly triplicity has been designated by astrologers as embodying the idea of planes, Taurus, upon which, you know, the various type of hoofed animals graze, of caves, Virgo, and of rock, Capricorn. So he'll make an analogy here. The deep and subtle interior experiences equate with retirement into the cave. These are the experiences of Virgo, but they even deepen in the caves within the rocks of Capricorn. It might be stated that these caves exist in the rocks deep under the plains. And here he puts all three together. I'm speaking figuratively and symbolically, of course. Okay. Out of the rocky cave, the Christ emerged, resurrected, and he walked again upon the plains of earth. And from that time, the woman knew him not. The woman wanted to touch him, and as is recounted in the Bible, he said, "Touch me not, I have not yet gone to the Father." And I suppose that was for her own benefit as well, as there was probably some electrical phenomenon occurring which would have been of great danger to the one who touched. The third aspect of divinity could no longer hold the risen, resurrected Christ. Let's put that down. The third aspect of divinity could no longer hold the risen, resurrected Christ. So the woman, or the third aspect of divinity, no longer could entrap the consciousness. The planes in this particular case seem a little bit superficial. Below the planes, in the rocky caverns, is where the real initiatory work is going on, but there are, of course, higher interpretations of Taurus rather than this rather superficial green and grassy interpretation, but, of course, supplying the nourishment that we need. The planes of Taurus, and let's put that in there, supplying nourishment. Because, after all, things do grow on the plains under the light of the sun. And Taurus is one of the great signs of the providing of food, but then so is Virgo. But in this context, Virgo is seen as the symbol of an inner retirement where illumination can be nurtured. An inner state of retirement where illumination can be nurtured. So, putting them all together, the caves exist in the rocks, deep under the plains. These are the caves of initiation, and indeed they do. And when initiation was given in the earlier days, these were the places of initiation. So these are the caves of initiation, figuratively and symbolically. And then from the lower depths, returning the resurrected soul aspect can walk again upon the plains, visible to man, walk again upon the plains of earth, visible to man. And Taurus again has to do with vision, does it not? Taurus and vision and the full appearance of the resurrected initiate. Form had no further hold upon him. That is, the earth signs being primarily signs of form, for he had overcome it in the depths. And what do we mean by that? We mean overcome it in the depths, i.e. within the caves of initiation. Into the cave of initiation, the light of resurrection streams. When the stone at the entrance is rolled away. And this is the rolling away of the stone, is the symbol of freedom from material life. Notice how, of the four factors, DK is here dealing with symbolization. And he's giving us, in certain quite evocative symbols, a story of a much, much higher process. From life in the form to death of the form, deep in the rocky place, down in the crypts of the temple, the human being goes. So this is describing the great initiatory process in relation to which Capricorn is so prominent. From life in the form, which is very Taurian, to death of the form, which is Capricornian in its nature, deep, as the moon is in detriment in Capricorn, deep in the rocky place, down in the crypts of the temple, the human being goes. So there is a certain type of death to superficial living which is occurring in the caves of initiation. But into that same place, the new life streams, bringing fresh life and liberation. If we retire into our cave, each one of us can do this in our consciousness, the higher light and life streams in. and a new degree of livingness will arise, and liberation from the cave will occur. The rock will be rolled away, and we will be able to walk the plains of earth as full initiates in this world and yet not of it, our consciousness firmly centered in the higher place to which the dynamic of resurrection has elevated us. Every type of initiation is a type of resurrection, even though the true resurrection is not that following the fourth degree, but really at the seventh degree. Old things pass away, and the darkness becomes light, which is a great Taurian and Venusian theme. Oh, there's so much here, isn't there? So much. We are being liberated into light. The resurrective experience involves the blinding light. Who knows what the actual occult dynamics were, how this was actually achieved. Was it the Master Jesus that was resurrected, or was it the Christ working upon the entombed vehicle of the Master Jesus that caused this resurrection? Because the Christ, after all, was an ascended being. Well, at least he was at that time an initiate of the sixth degree, incipiently so, and had the capacity to infuse that vehicle with a translation into an entirely different state, which that translation we call resurrection. A resurrection onto the cosmic ethers and out of the dense physical body of the Soto Logos and Planetary Logos altogether. Now, these are just words to us indicating the experience which lies ahead inevitably for each of us sooner or later, depending upon our choices. So we have come now to the end of Esoteric Astrology 108B, page. Be nice to be able to determine the page. 385, looks like. And beginning of Esoteric Astrology 108C, page 385. Okay.